So, Gats here, if you're like me, you love a good stat, but there's one stat you probably don't know, your vehicle's battery charge. That's why Advance Auto Parts has free vehicle battery testing and installation with no appointment needed. Battery start at just $79.99. They also have curbside pickup on any order. Enter the code DAN20 when you buy online to save 20% on your order. Advance your auto at Advance Auto Parts and participating CarQuest locations. See stores for details.
Okay, everybody. Welcome into this week's edition of the David Sampson Show. I am joined by David Sampson, just David Sampson. All right, lots of feedback to what happened last week with Ariel Helwani, ESPN MMA journalist and hurt, passionate Montreal Expo fan. He challenged you on a lot of stuff. Many argue he might have crossed the line a little bit in terms of personal attacks. I think he was being an emotional fan. The thing that made me most uncomfortable, David, and there was a lot there that made me uncomfortable, but the most uncomfortable was that interaction. Like, I feel like we just got off on the wrong foot. And the whole deal with your original opinion that you encountered anti-Semitism and then Ariel coming on, I think personally, incorrectly, saying who are you to say that this exists? I don't think a person's personal experiences, as we're learning throughout these couple of weeks, should be really cast in doubt. However, you did seem a little uncomfortable speaking up about your own personal experience, which might have helped you in that situation, but to each his own. What do you make of that a week after that specific interaction?
I just found it strange that he led off the interview or the debate or whatever you wanted to call it. You know, you as the moderator, you're in a position where you're trying to foment conversation between two people that could have been a very interesting conversation. He's a very talented journalist and a very smart guy. And I knew when he started off by saying that I don't have the right to feel how I feel, it was over. And we went for an hour and a half, and he just went off the rails. And he continued to go off the rails the entire time. And when you're talking to somebody, and I have 18 years experience dealing with people who have emotion about a sports team, so I know how to do it. And the key to success when you're talking to someone is you have to let them talk. And he was criticized vociferously for claiming that he won 10-7, which is a blowout, I guess, in MMA world. And I didn't respond. I just let it be, because at the end of the day, I want to give him his opportunity. 19 years of vent up. What's the expression? Bent up frustration?
Pent up with a P.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Pent up frustration. And I just let him go. And Mike, I wasn't upset. I wasn't unhappy. I didn't take pleasure in all of the social media blowback that he got and all of the credit I got. That's not just like when people are critical of me. I don't take it personally. When people are excited about something I've done or in favor of me or choose me, I don't get excited about that either. For me, I try to stay level-headed and steady. And I think you've seen during the course of these interviews and the Local Hour and the Times with Billy Corbin, that's just how I am. And I'll give the facts as I see them and as I manufacture them. And yes, do I manufacture facts? That's not making up facts, Mike. That's explaining why I do what I do and what was in my mind when I did it. And that means it's my truth.
I actually don't really cast what you're saying into doubt. I think maybe they're built on a faulty premise, and that's for a larger debate. Whether you are right or wrong in what you're actually executing certainly can be called into question, at least from my personal experience here down in Florida. I couldn't help but notice you didn't really address my initial question, and this is where I felt most uncomfortable as moderator, understanding that both you and Ariel are Jewish. My antenna is up for what is going on there. I can't help but notice you still don't feel comfortable mentioning specific instances, and I'm not going to push you to that. Just as someone that was trying to moderate and get control of the situation, I also feel like I'm crossing a line by pressing on that one specific thing, because I felt like if you had an example, maybe it would have eased tensions. Would it not?
Well, no, because again, when you're trying to tell somebody, he misunderstood when he thought that I was impugning the entirety of Montreal and the entirety of the province of Quebec. And that's not what I was doing. I have gotten 8 or 10 direct messages on Twitter at David P. Sampson, if I can plug that, with examples of anti-Semitism in Quebec. in articles as recently as a month ago of things that went on. But by the way, there's anti-Semitism all over the world. And that is unfortunately the case. And we're seeing what racial inequality and prejudice. And I'm certainly not saying that I've ever walked in the shoes, nor will I ever walk in the shoes of any black person experiencing what they experience in the United States. What I'm saying is that when I was in Montreal, I could bring out the cartoons that I saved that I have where they were purposefully making my face look as though, you know, with the big nose and the hook nose and things that they do. I could tell you about meetings I had with certain of the limited partners who were acknowledged to be anti-Semitic. But really, that's not the issue. What bothered Helwani is that he thought that I was casting a wide net, and I would never do that because that's an example of when you run into a problem, and we're seeing it in the country bubbling over right now. You cannot say that because one person, the best example, Mike, let's talk about Boston. This was the biggest story that I've seen in my 18 years in sports, and I'm not giving you hyperbole. The Red Sox owners release a statement acknowledging that many of their fans, some of their fans, one of their fans, any number of their fans, their paying public, are racist and say racial epithets. That's unbelievable. That doesn't mean all of Boston is prejudiced.
It kind of got swallowed by everything that was going on with NASCAR and the Confederate flag, but I think this is an admission by the Boston Red Sox that they've been sort of covering this up too. They don't really address that directly. They said that they had just last season alone, 7 instances in which either their staff or players were racially abused. That would have been helpful, during the time of Adam Jones and his initial allegations. Honestly, when I see that statement, I'm like, where were you when Adam Jones said this, Boston? Were you actually covering this up when you could have spoke up then?
By the way, they said 7 reported incidences, way more than that. When we were in the league over that time period, there were certain places that many of our players, and I spoke to Juan Pierre about this many times, just didn't like going. And Boston, Philadelphia is another example where fans, and this is not anything against the city of Philadelphia or everyone there, so be clear, I'm not saying that, but there are bad people. And there are bad people who to their core. And what Torrey Hunter said is when he looks up in the stands and someone calls him the N-word and they're sitting with their son, that is how racism crosses generations. And it's supposed to stop. We're trying to do everything we can to stop it so that sons and daughters of racist people don't become racist. But if that's the behavior that's modeled, that's how it perpetuates and crosses generations. And this has been going on my entire career, where this stuff was happening in Boston. So it's not that they were covering it up, Mike. They knew very well. But the pressure for them to talk now was overwhelming, and that's why they did it.
Yeah, I think you're kind of seeing with Boston. I think Boston and that rabid sports fan base, along with Philadelphia, is the closest thing that you have here in America to like soccer hooliganism. And soccer obviously has a very checkered past. The club that I work for, Chelsea, like every other club in Europe, has a checkered past, and they're trying to move the conversation. They're trying to abolish this from the game, having their programs. I know during the season, my first ever work with Chelsea last year was a final whistle on hate, and they played an exhibition match while their season, they had a European final in Baku. Which I didn't even know where that was, just like a week and a half later. They played a match in New England called the Final Whistle on Hate, and they raised an upwards of $7 million for programs that fight anti-Semitism. They know their responsibility. They know their past. They know they have to be leaders on this. When they hear it in the stands and they actually get proof of it, they eject that fan for life. I hope we see more of that going on with Boston. I hope some of these people are exposed. And the people that are silent are also exposed because they're part of the problem. This is not the first time. Torrey Hunter's not the first time. Adam Jones is not the first time. Carl Crawford is not the first time. It's a very well-known open secret. You ask anybody, any person of color, or any white person that has stood by their teammates and heard this too. There's been far too much silence on it. And I hope it gets more national attention because obviously the NASCAR thing happened at the same time. And given NASCAR's fan base so directly tied to the South, I understand that being a bigger national story. But the Red Sox admitting that they've been quiet on this now have to turn the page and become leaders in initiating change.
It is the biggest baseball story of the year. It's bigger than the labor negotiations, and it's got a chance to be a longer lasting story, and it's got a chance to be the story that actually can effectuate change. And NASCAR, what they did, I want to give them credit. I'm going to talk about it on Nothing Personal today. It's major when you know that your fan base believes one thing. And I'm not talking about one fan or two fans, but I could argue a majority of the fan base believes in the right of the Confederate flag to be flown. This is a big deal. And what they're saying is they did an economic calculus, and they also did a righteous calculus. And they came to this conclusion for the first time in the history of that sport. What happens now with sponsors, with fans, with the economics of the sport? It's going to be very interesting, and I'm very hopeful.
It very much feels like what's happening culturally. This was a conversation, an angry conversation that really, it's been going on for decades, centuries even. But we didn't finish the business that we started in 2015. There was unfinished business there, and it's been boiling over for 4 years. And now, congruent with everything that's going on with the rest of politics, with this pandemic, people out of work and having the time to actually go shut down places of mass congregation, this is starting to finish something that was really starting in earnest as a true change in our cultural philosophy with Mike Brown and what was happening in Ferguson. And it's a long time coming, certainly for the Red Sox. Back to Ariel and last week's episode. I did mention what you were mentioning as anti-Semitism. Is there a possibility that what you were running into maybe wasn't anti-Semitism, but just anti-American, anti-non-French speaker, and maybe you were internalizing that as I'm different, they're judging me because I'm different, and then you start itemizing what makes you different? Is there a chance of that?
Well, by the way, that is a great question that a lot of therapeutic hours have been spent on, because what you're asking me to do is separate what I have grown up, my reality of growing up Jewish. And I grew up surrounded. I went to a school, a high school Horace Mann, that was predominantly Jewish. I grew up very privileged in a big bubble. And yet there were moments, because I traveled and I was able to see parts of the world, where I knew early on how lucky I was to live such a sheltered life. And so am I more sensitive, you're asking, to anti-Semitism? Am I more sensitive to hateful speech or to prejudice physically? I was made fun of relentlessly because of my size growing up, because of my mouth growing up, where I would try to talk my way out of anything all the time. I've been doing that since first grade and getting in trouble for it as the class clown and everything else. Was I trying to overcompensate for my perceived inequities? And the answer is, I don't know how to tell you anything other than what my reality is. And my reality is, I don't see the difference when I am looked at in Canada, when I'm trying to do business, when I'm trying to get things done, and I'm finding people not wanting to deal with me for what I consider to be economically irrational reasons. And then when I see that it is not a conversation that is, listen, in business, you have conversations where you don't come to a deal. And there are reasons, and you're okay with it. You shake hands, you move on. That happens every day. I had happened to me in Montreal more than anywhere else. Things stopped me from doing deals that I couldn't understand. Is it possible it's because I was American? Is it possible because of all the bad things that went on in Montreal prior to me arriving there? Is it possible because I was Jewish? Is it possible because I was short, white? My name was David. It could be anything. So of course you're right that I absolutely may have mislabeled my experiences, but that doesn't change how I felt internally. And I didn't need to explain that to Ariel. You don't need to explain that to anyone except yourself as you work through how you navigate this life.
I admire your willingness to put your face into the buzzsaw, because, you know, in bringing on Ariel Helwani, I'm setting up for fireworks, because I think it's good content the way that you've engaged Billy Corbin in dialogue. And I feel bad personally And the Jason Leisure thing, I had no idea that was going to turn into that. And that's honestly the most embarrassed I've been in terms of, I think, someone perhaps crossing the line, because you didn't know Jason Leisure and you didn't really know what you were walking into. You knew to a degree that it was going to be contentious with Ariel. You knew to a degree it was going to be contentious with Billy Corbin. I admire that you're willing to do it. I feel in cases with Billy, certainly with Jason, and now with Ariel, the conversation's gotten away from me. I don't know what it is about David Samson, but people come in with their preconceived notions, and some of them are justified, David, because, look, you're never going to escape the stain of taking away someone's team, someone's feel-good, a team that they grew up with in Montreal, and you're certainly not going to escape what happened down here in Miami with the stadium. You've eloquently defended your position on it. I have heard the factors. I hear where you're coming from, and I still feel like we got done dirty, and I wanted the stadium being built. And I have what happened in retrospect, and really what I felt was the final straw was I just felt lied to. Forget about the taxpayer stuff, and Billy can speak to that a lot better than I can. Billy Corbin, that is. I just felt like you guys made a promise that if we got you this stadium, if I championed with my platform on the show as a huge Marlins fan, as someone that was living and dying with every Jorge Cantu at bat, I felt like if I championed your cause with our platform, we'd get the stadium and we'd have a competitive baseball team, and the same stuff that was happening to my baseball team over those horrible lean years post 2003, even though we had some competitive teams, but I would get my hopes up and know that my team just wouldn't be buyers. They would ultimately be sellers, and I would be saying goodbye to players like Miguel Cabrera. I was like, well, that's done. We got them a stadium. And then almost immediately, you guys did it to me again. And I was like, they got me. They got me again.
And Mike, you understand my position on this, which is no one is more upset than I am, because when you say that I can't escape it, part of my people's legacy gets written over the course of their lives through things they do and things they say, and you have to own it. So it was never a matter of me. You're acting as though I should be complimented for not running away from my reality. Who would do that? Only people who are scared or who have regrets or who are unwilling to admit that they're anything but perfect. I'm far from perfect. I've made tons of mistakes over the course of my professional life, my personal life. I am who I am today because of my successes and my failures. And there's so many people I've come across in the sports world who are and in the business world and in the media world now, who are unwilling to ever admit any mistakes and don't own up to anything. And long ago, I learned the lesson that you have to own up to your truth and to how you approach situations. And then you're judged if you're judged. And sometimes it's negative, sometimes it's positive. But what good would it be to deny you the right to feel the way you feel? I would never do that. But then on the same side, you keep bringing people to talk to me on your show, and their view is the opposite of mine. They want to deny me the right to even talk or to say anything about my truth or my feeling. And that seems to be the common thread of the people that you bring in to talk to me, mm-hmm. is that they just want to regurgitate this anger and then don't want to hear anything. And that, to me, is not how you grow and have progress.
Well, I do try to bring someone else on because you speak so eloquently on your position, and you have the benefit of being in these rooms. All I have the benefit of is being a fan, having my truth, believing what I read in some papers, and holding up several Jeff Passan articles that are absolutely torching you guys. So I try to bring in other people. And Ariel, I knew he was a journalist. I didn't expect him to call that TV executive. I was really bummed out to hear that you failed to mention in the first episode of the Expos how quickly that meeting went, that you sort of got up there. Ariel said this TV executive claimed that it was a 5-minute meeting, and you got up and stormed out. I'm like, well, that's a bad
look.
First
of all, Mike, can I just explain to you, Jerry Frappier, great guy, but stormed out. I'd like you to picture the number of meetings that I have stormed out of, and it is many. Now, how does storming manifest itself? I don't throw papers up in the air and say, you know, F you and run out the door.
Well, maybe you do.
I am merely, no. I am merely an efficient guy, and I don't want my time wasted, and I'm not going to waste someone else's time, because that's the only thing, and I'm the most controlling person I've ever met. The only thing I've learned in my life that I cannot control is time passing. So therefore, I'm very respectful of other people's time. That's why I'm never late. I'm on time. And I don't like people who are late. I don't like waiting for people. Waiting at doctor's offices is something that drives me absolutely insane. Why would you have 10 people have a 9 a.m. appointment? Why is that? Tell me to come at 9:17 and I'll come at 9:17. These things make me crazy. So when it became clear that Jerry Frappier was not going to do a deal, I merely said there's nothing else to talk about because I'm not willing to not get more money in a deal this coming year. He said we're not willing to pay it. And there was nothing to say. So that was that. And that wasn't the only meeting where, quote unquote, I stormed out. So when you say I failed to mention it, to me, it's not exactly, you know, it's not something that I would say, hey, Mike, guess what? I stormed out of a meeting with Jerry Frappier. I hope Ariel doesn't call him.
I mean, but mentioning that it went just 5 minutes would allow me the opportunity to press you on that, would also allow the opportunity for the audience to make up their own mind in this instance, because I have no idea this meeting ever existed, and I'm just getting your side of it, which is, I'm sort of defending myself in getting someone like Ariel on.
I wasn't upset with you at all.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, Mike. Hold on. I agreed. You didn't surprise me with Ariel.
Yeah.
I knew exactly. You actually said, by the way, it's going to be an extra long local hour, so make sure you get your sleep. I had Lebatard calling me, who said, by the way, you understand you just agreed to go into the ring with someone who will have no problem leaving you battered and bloody. And I said, see you later, Dan. No problem. And not no problem that I was going to win 10-7 or lose 10-7. It's I understand the importance of debate and having a story and giving content and letting people judge for themselves. So I'm sorry if you thought I misled you in any answer I gave you. But, Mike, I give you answers, and it's your job to ask deeper, more questions to get more information. It's not my job as the person being interviewed to give you more than I want to give you.
100%. And I did have the self-awareness to know I'm not equipped for this particular conversation, so I wanted to bring in Ariel. Speaking of Ariel, I haven't directly spoken to him. I after we recorded and posted the podcast, I did shoot a text thanking him for doing it. And then I had a group text that I sent to both you and him, once again, thanking you for the time and sort of extending an olive branch to see if you guys could directly connect. I've been, and truthfully, I'm a little embarrassed to reach out to Ariel because I didn't expect him to get hit so hard on social media. What he's retweeted doesn't exactly mirror what's going on in my mentions. Once again, it seems as though David Samson has won over the neutrals by just not being emotional, which is a fairly smart tactic by you, because you're just quiet and composed in these situations. You let the emotional, angry person release years of pent-up frustration, and just sonically, it's a solid dub for you. Have you spoken to Ariel directly since last week's local hour?
Yeah, so we texted that day. You gave me his number, and I just, let me see if I can get you the text, because it was pretty funny. And, he was, when we first texted, just so you know, in his mind, it was a blowout, an absolute blowout. And he was practically apologetic to me, but, I just said my only thing that bothered me about it, and I'm actually happy to go public with this, is I wrote to him, and I wrote at 11 o'clock, I said, Victor Conte? Exclamation point. Victor Conte? Seriously, though, nice to meet you. Look forward to the next time we speak. Have a safe day. He said, same here. Enjoyed it. One of these days, it would be nice to talk in person. If our paths cross again, take care. I said, that would be great.
Okay.
And then that was that. And so it was, we had a little more back and forth about where he lives and where I live and how our paths could ever cross. But he had no idea at that time what was coming, and I've not heard from him since, nor have I contacted him since. However, I will mention that maybe the reason he's got 900,000 followers and I have 14,000 followers is he's way better at this than I am, because he's retweeted every single Montrealer who said something negative about me and positive about him, and I didn't retweet any of the stuff that was positive about me and negative about him. So maybe the joke's on me.
Yeah, he's pretty good at the social media game, and I don't know how he's internalizing what I've seen in my mentions, just as a neutral who's interested in seeing what the general feedback is from what I've seen on the Reddit, from what I've seen in my mentions. Again, it looks like you won just by merely not being emotional. I do want to talk about one of the points that I brought up at the end of last week's podcast that, as I try to crack you open once again, a more seasoned David Sampson, the David Sampson that got the stadium deal done in Miami. If I take that David Sampson, who by that time had walked out of scores of five-minute meetings in his life, if I take that David Sampson that was scarred by all of those experiences and I put him in the spot of 31-year-old David Sampson, was it, running things for the Montreal Expos, does that David Sampson save the Montreal Expos? We didn't dig deep enough on that, and I think that there might be some good stuff there. David, let's concentrate on this. Season David Sampson, does he save the Montreal Expos?
No. Because we came in to – we went to a gunfight with a knife. Such an unfortunate expression because I don't like guns or knives other than to cut food. But the Montreal, when we got there, it was a wing and a prayer for that franchise to be saved. They had been on life support for years, and there was such rancor between the current owner at the time, Claude Brochu, and his partners who became our partners. And baseball was just tired of it. But Bud Selig, as a personal favor, who was the commissioner at the time, as a personal favor to his close friend, Charles Bronfman, who was the original owner, as Ariel had pointed out, and a longtime owner of the Expos, he wanted to help Charles save baseball in Montreal, but knew it could not be saved. He allowed Jeffrey to buy the team, thinking, listen, maybe he can get something done, but it'll be a miracle. Likely contraction will happen if the union allows for it. And that'll be the end of the Montreal Expos, and I will be able to show Charles Bronfman, Bud said to himself, that we tried. We wanted a local owner. I think what Ariel doesn't realize, and it's revisionist history, and it happened in Miami too, and I think you don't realize how serious this statement is. And you've said it, but we didn't dig deep enough.
Yeah, I think I know the point that you're making. I made this point for you last week.
It's not a point for me. It's just the reality of what was going on in Montreal. When we say that we were the last and final choice to go into a situation, that is not saying that we were the third to last. We were the absolute last, not because we're not good at what we do, not because we're not nice people. It's because the situations were so bleak in the communities where we were entering. Montreal first and then Miami second. Do you know, we didn't talk about this. Have you ever heard of an executive named Larry Lucchino?
Yeah, I've heard the name.
Larry Lucchino is a big time president. He was involved with the Padres. He was involved with the Red Sox, and he a very accomplished sports executive. Do you know that baseball hired Larry Lucchino to be in Miami and to look over John Henry's shoulders before we came to Miami and to judge for himself, Larry Lucchino, on behalf of baseball, whether a stadium deal could get done by anyone in Miami?
I had no
idea.
You
know why? Because it was never publicized. His report was never made public. When we moved out of Montreal into Miami, it was with the realization that the likelihood of a deal is de minimis. You are going from one problem in Montreal, which we are now handling because we are getting rid of the Expos and moving them to Washington, and you're not allowed to, which is what they were always going to do with the team. And you're going to a place in Miami where you're not going to get a deal done, which is why that whole loan from baseball happened the way it did, where we got an interest-free loan of $38.5 million that went to John Henry because he wanted $158 million for his team, and we would only pay $120 because that's all baseball would pay to buy the Expos. So all of it made sense when you're inside the room doing the negotiating, but the public didn't have an opportunity, and you're an example. As an emotional fan, you didn't have the opportunity to understand what was really going on in Miami when we got here. And that's exactly what was going on in Montreal, that Ariel would have no way of understanding what was going on, which is the book had been written. And whether I had been 50 years old, 40 years old, or 30 years old, there were far more experienced, far wealthier people who could have handled the issue, who didn't. Just like in Miami, Wayne Huizenga and John Henry are far wealthier, far more advanced than I ever was, than Jeffrey ever was. And the reason they couldn't get it done is they were unwilling to do what it took to get it done.
I can understand. I'm sorry to cut you off. I didn't mean to do that. But I can understand why this would make Ariel angry. As you guys there are making presentations about ballparks, it kind of feels like you kind of knew what the deal was when you bought this. And I know Jeffrey addressed the team and had this whole World Series discussion. We're going to turn this team into contenders and we're going to keep this team in Montreal doing all the rah-rah stuff. It's really hard for me to believe, just as an independent, that the discussion as you're buying this team between, I don't know how involved you were in the actual negotiation of the buying team, but in Jeffrey's deepest, most honest thoughts, if he wasn't just buying this team knowing that it was going to move anyways, and this was his only way into baseball, and once he got the Expos, he'd figure his next move out. But it wasn't about keeping the Montreal Expos in Montreal.
So let me answer that, because that's a great question. So I was involved during the entire negotiation to have Jeffrey become the general partner. And our view the entire time was that it would be preferable to get a ballpark in Montreal. It would be more cost effective to get a ballpark in Montreal and rebuild that team than it would be to pay a relocation fee to move, even if we got the votes to be allowed to move, which, by the way, as it turns out, we couldn't get, didn't get, and wouldn't get. There's no way in 1999 that it was even a kernel of a thought that, hey, in 2002, there could be a historic franchise swap. No chance. Did we say to ourselves, let's get in the game and we've got to do everything we can to get a ballpark in Montreal, and if it doesn't happen, we'll take it from there? Of course we said that. By the way, we said that in Miami too. We'll go to Miami. We're going to try to get a ballpark in Miami, and if it doesn't happen, we'll take it from there. But there was nothing nefarious about our intention. So I bring your attention to your favorite baseball team, the Miami Marlins, or your erstwhile favorite baseball team. When you have a team that you know is not going to be competitive, and we all know how our teams are because we are self-aware, owners or not, presidents and GMs are self-aware. Do you know we still go into spring training and have the same meeting with the team every first day of spring training? You're right. We're being picked to lose 100 games. We've all read it. You've read it. But you know what? We've got to play those games, and we can do it as a group. If we stick together, we can win. We can make the playoffs. We, of course, know that it's not likely, but we're going to try.
Yeah. I mean, Derek Jeter probably doesn't know, because he's had a lot of those rah-rah speeches, and I can see what's happening with him getting beaten down. And I can understand why Derek Jeter, who's not this enormously physically gifted player that had this Hall of Fame career that's one of the great winners in baseball history, thinking that he could just will some of these poor teams to victory. And it's not happening for him. And it's a bit of an adjustment period. I'm sure it was even an adjustment period for you, because you guys had fairly early success and you won a championship in 2003, not long after you guys came into owning the teams. Once you get a taste of that, you probably, number one, feel some sort of affirmation and positive reinforcement that, yeah, I am the man. I did this. And it takes quite the recalibration for you guys in those leaner years, doesn't it?
It's the hardest thing in the world is winning one World Series, because your whole goal, so many people go through their careers. I spoke to Andre Dawson about this all the time, because he never won one as a player. I've spoken to Bud Selig, who never won one as an owner, and that's all he ever wanted. And it's all you think about. And the problem is, when you're competitive the way many of us are, the minute you win one and that was your entire goal, the goal line moves and you want to win your second. And the problem with that is, if that bleeds into your life, which it has with me, then there's no finish line ever. You're never satisfied with anything. And that is one of my great personality faults, I would say, is that some people would say, well, that's what drives them to succeed. And I would say that that's what drives me to be miserable more often than I'm not, and to be not emotional and to have the shell around me, because I'm never satisfied. And in a world where you can never take incremental victories, I remember the day after we won the World Series, I missed the parades in Fort Lauderdale, the boat parade, because I was negotiating to try to get a ballpark, trying to take advantage of the momentum.
Wow.
So I chose to miss the parade willingly. And it turns out we didn't get a deal during those negotiations, and we then had to build the team up and then tear it down in 06. And I look back at that and I think, Can you imagine not even taking enough time to enjoy a World Series parade in Fort Lauderdale? I did the one in Miami and then had to go to work, and they were the same day. And I've done a lot wrong, Mike. There's no doubt about it. And I wish that I were more able to understand my successes and my failures and be satisfied, but I'm just not.
Wow. I have that unexpected turn in this one. Let me try to crack you open a little bit more, because one of the things that we closed last week with is I was trying to level with Ariel. I'm like, yes, Samson is, in my eyes and in your guys, Samson and Loria, they're the bane of the baseball existence, right? They're the bad guys ultimately in Montreal. Although really the Major League Baseball strike in 94 should really be considered the bad guy when you look at the Expos. Quantifiably, I think that did more to end that franchise than certainly anything that Brofman did, and even though he was a part of that, and you guys did thereafter. That's the wheels began turning in motion with that strike. You would agree, right, David?
There's no question. Well, it's actually after the strike, the team, the Expos, had to trade a bunch of players when the season restarted in 1995. So they didn't have a chance to finish 94 when they had the best record in baseball and were going to be a playoff team for the first time maybe since 81. And then on top of that, after that, the revenue went away because the owners at the time were just not willing to put the money in that was required.
Yeah, so I can totally understand a Montreal Expos fan thinking that you were just some puppet and Major League Baseball wanted baseball out of Montreal. They screwed us out of a World Series with their greed, and I could totally understand. We're a Montreal Expo fan. Just Samson and Loria, non-starter for me. They were just the final puppets in place. I got the team for a joke of a price anyways, and they were part of this larger plan to have this baseball franchise swap, and we were never really part of the plan. So I understand that, and I would subscribe to all these conspiracy theories. But really, what I'm trying to get to is, we have bad guys. We have your faces. We have Jeffrey Loria. We have David Samson. And we should probably direct our anger to the businessmen in our cities that Major League Baseball would have rather sold the teams to, but nobody in those communities would step up to save baseball, to take the financial hit, at least initially. Lord knows you guys cashed out several times over. But really, that's a problem. I, as angry as I get with you for that Toronto trade after, I was embarrassed by how proudly we touted you and championed that cause. And then I felt betrayed almost immediately. But also, how do I reconcile that? Someone that's turned me against the sport with someone that also someone that saved the franchise in this market. Got something done that none of the other owners, however murky and dirty that stadium deal got done, it got done. And by all accounts, it saved the franchise down here. How do I reconcile that? I'm asking you, as someone that was at the center of all that.
I think that you reconcile it the first time you take your child to a game, right? I don't know if you've had a chance to do it. I wish that more people were going to games under Derek Jeter, and he thought that I was the problem. And I've said this, and it makes me smile. And I don't root against Derek, but I certainly don't appreciate what he has done to the legacy, to my legacy. While, as I told you in the beginning, legacies get written over time and there's ups and there's downs, and I don't shy away from any of it. But by Jeter thinking that all he had to do was, you know, sprinkle his pixie dust and he'd get a better TV deal than I can negotiate. He'd get more fans. He would get a better winning team. He'd
finally get a naming rights deal.
Which, by the way, he's done none of it, right? The only thing that he's done is has a higher ranked minor league system. And that doesn't keep a baseball fan warm at night in Miami. At least it shouldn't. What it does do is it gives you hope. Hey, maybe these guys will grow up and they'll be the centerpiece of the next round of a good team. And that's great. I understand. And I hope that it's true. But I think that Derek's problem here in Miami is that he came in thinking, not understanding the market at all, not understanding the reality of what happens here in Miami. And it's not just with the Marlins, because we could talk about the Dolphins and the Heat and the Panthers. This is not a David Samson issue. While I certainly did my part to hurt it, and I did my part to help it, maybe not in equal parts, but for you or anybody else down here to even think, and I know you don't, Mike, you can't possibly think the Marlins are the outlier when it comes to some of the issues that sports teams have in Miami.
No, I don't think that they're the outlier, but I do think they're the chief example. And I do think that maybe projecting all of my anger onto Jeffrey Loria and the Loria administration is unfair, especially after discussing things with you. I do think it's fair to maybe turn some of my ire to Major League Baseball, because they had a set price in mind, because you guys are setting a watermark. If the Marlins can go for this price, imagine what so-and-so could go for. And Major League Baseball overvalues. You guys also overvalue the franchise. And you put an owner in a hole, and they already have the built-in excuse. Hey, this team was overpriced, and it's just the same thing. Rinse, repeat. We don't have the means to actually go out and compete early on. We're going to have to tear down the greatest outfield ever. We're going to have to make arguably the second worst trade in Major League Baseball history behind the first worst trade. Yes, anybody that was scarred by Miguel Cabrera and now be scarred by Christian Yelich. And I think Major League Baseball is really the problem here. And I don't really know how much they've cared for this. And I know Dan took a lot of these issues directly up with the commissioner of baseball. But I think the Predator meme is Expos holding one arm up and Marlins fans extending and meeting in the middle, and it's Major League Baseball that was the problem ultimately with those baseball cities.
Do you think for 1 minute that Major League Baseball forced Bruce Sherman and Derek Jeter to wire the money to buy the team? Do you think that they forced for 1 minute? As a matter of fact, Major League Baseball, Rob Manfred, made me meet with Derek Jeter and tell him you can't be the control person, mm-hmm. right? So I had to explain to Derek that his dream of being the lead guy was never going to happen because I couldn't get him the votes. And he was furious. Derek and I went to a meeting in New York with the commissioner where we rehearsed it, and the commissioner was going to be the one to tell Derek. We get in the meeting, and it's crickets. And all of a sudden, Derek's looking at me. I'm looking at Rob. Rob's looking at Derek. And there's silence, and I have to step up and say, Derek, we're here because we have to find you a control person because it can't be you. And Derek Jeter said, this is outrageous, and he called for a sidebar with Rob, and he kicked me out of the room. It was insane. But in no way did baseball – in any way say, man, we want to get Derek Jeter here, and it's got to be 1.2 because otherwise you're not allowed to sell. And no chance that happened. All that happened is that Bruce Sherman and Derek Jeter so badly wanted it that they believed that they would pay anything because Derek made Bruce believe that he would do way better than I was able to do. And now we're 3 years later and it didn't happen, which is why the Marlins have financial troubles.
But why does Major League Baseball want Derek Jeter to have a franchise so bad? Bruce Sherman was not the first person he tried partnering up with. Just from a financials point of view, Derek Jeter has no business being in this room with you and Rob Manfred and asking for control over a franchise when he's cash poor, comparative to the rest of the MLB owners. Why are they shoving Derek Jeter down everybody's throat as someone that has to be the face of this franchise? I'm saying this from the burnt fan perspective.
So there was a time during the bidding where we had made it clear what number that Jeffrey had made it clear and I had made it clear what number we wanted for the Marlins. And Jorge Mas had said that he would hit that number. And I called Rob on a Monday because I had a weekend to talk to Jeffrey and to figure out, are we going to go with the Jeter bid or with the Jorge Mas bid? And we called Jorge Mas and said, you've got the team. We've chosen you. While it would be great to have Derek Jeter as the face, and there was a lot of positive sort of vibes around having Derek Jeter in an ownership role for many reasons.
Yeah.
George Mas got the call from me, and George Mas got a call from Rob saying, you are the chosen person. All you have to do is show that you can close the deal, do the ownership application, and he didn't do it. He actually was unable to have and show that he had the economic wherewithal to buy the team at the number that he said he could. And I spoke to George about this. I've not gone public with this, but he knows this and he won't deny this. The reality was he was not in a position at that time where he could be the control person and put the amount of money in it and get the money together. I had so many meetings with George Mas because I thought for Miami, that would be better than Derek Jeter. having someone in the community because of what I had learned in Montreal. But at the end of the day, my responsibility was to Jeffrey and to the other limited partners of his, not to the community. And I know that is going to sound so horrible, but that was my job, to get the most money I could for the team that I was told to sell. Yeah. And so when Jorge Mas couldn't get the number, we went back to Derek Jeter and said, listen, the team is yours. Start cobbling together. And that's what he did with 21 or 22 limited partners to get to the total end price.
Yeah. And from the fan perspective, I'm like, therein lies the problem. But it also carries such a naivete attached to it, because ultimately these are business people. This is a capitalistic venture. And who am I to say, well, take less money if you want Jorge Mas to be the face of South Florida baseball. Take his money if you feel so passionately that he is the better fit for it. But no, you guys got to get to that $1.2 billion or whatever. And that's sort of what hurts. And maybe if you guys take a lower price, but you're not going to take a lower price. That's just not the reality of the situation. This is not an altruistic venture, owning a baseball team. You guys made one of the greatest sports investments ever. You turned $12 million into $1.2 billion, bleep you.
Well, that's not exactly the math, as you know, because 1.2 was the enterprise number. You'd have to take away all the debt and all the losses, yes, that Jeffrey had put in.
But $12 million got your foot in the door.
100%. And by the way, it was a great investment for Jeffrey, and as it should be. And there's no way I'm going to sit here and apologize for not taking less from a Wayne Rothbaum or a Jorge Mas. But if you think for one minute that I'm the only one and that this is unique to Miami and unique to me, that's just not the case. It's everybody in every business, you, completely 100% of the time.
It's nothing personal.
It's just business, Mike. You know that. But the fact is, sports is such an emotional business that you get people like Ariel to land this plane and go full circle. I know that I have to deal with people like Ariel, not just when a deal is happening, but for years after, decades after. This was built up for decades in him. There's no other business that happens when you sell that all of a sudden someone is so hurt. Like if your gym changes hands and they change out the equipment and all of a sudden you don't have the Stairmaster you like or the elliptical, you don't have this anger for 20 years. You go to a new gym.
Yeah, but
in sports, it doesn't work that way. Yeah,
no, it doesn't. And you deserve, I hope you understand, you deserve the blowback, because the gym that I go to doesn't traffic in tribalism and pride. Like, that's what you're marketing to. Hometown passion and love for this sport. This is a part of the community. This is a part of you. Your baseball team represents you. My gym doesn't try to sway that with their marketing plans. They're not trafficking in tribalism the way that sports does. So obviously it's great when you're setting World Series attendance records when things are going well. You're immediately taking that World Series championship and trying to leverage it to get a stadium, because you have a groundswell of public support, because you gave people feel good and you're feeding off of that. And sometimes when it goes bad, it can turn, not necessarily on a dime, but it can certainly turn the other way. And now you're getting anger as opposed to joy.
Listen, of course, when you are in a position like this in sports, there is going to be anger and there is going to be joy. And the only hope is that you can be around long enough to experience both. Because the reality is, some people are in the game of sports, in the business of sports, and all they get is the anger. There are some people who would say they get only joy. I'm trying to think who that is. Who has been an owner or president or GM or manager or player who's gotten, well, players, some of them do, but who get just joy?
Man,
I mean, I can't think of it. Was Wayne Huizenga, do you think he got just joy?
No.
Not even close. John Henry has won 4 championships in Boston, 4 World Series. Would he say to you, especially given what's going on right now and what's going on with science and everything else, that he's had just joy? I'm not sure that any owner would ever be able to say that. And that's the price of doing business.
Who's got the sweetest deal in all of ownership that's had the most joy? I mean, John Henry is as good of one, because he also owns Liverpool and they won Champions League last year and they're positioned to win the Premier League this year. Man, that's, yeah, you run the spectrum. And as you articulated, winning one just makes you want to chase another one, because you want to
so badly
capture that high. A host of Nothing Personal, David Samson. We're running out of time here. I owe you, it feels like, a dozen movie reviews. So let's get into this week's review.
So I've had an interesting situation happen the last couple of weeks. Like all of us, I'm not sleeping well. I'm watching more movies and I'm trying to learn more and watch much more serious movies. And it got to the point 2 days ago where I just felt so heavy. I don't know if that ever happens to you, Mike, where you just, you feel like you're weighed down by the seriousness of a moment. And I just, it almost paralyzed me. So I decided that I had to go to some sort of movie where I was guaranteed that I would forget about life for a while. So I want to bring up an old movie that is an example of something that you can do and not feel guilty about it. Guiltless pleasure. I watched Napoleon Dynamite.
Ah, classic.
For the first, but I hadn't watched it in, I don't know, 5 years. And I just thought about the look of John Hader. And that's the look I wanted. I wanted just someone who's like oblivious, right? So if you had to describe his character, it's oblivious to anything going on around him. And I wanted to feel that way. And so I put it on because I wanted to escape. And I felt guilty after I finished, because why would I be able to want to escape and be able to escape a situation where there are many people in their life they can't escape ever? They are confronted with the problems of today, every day, all day. So it was a very much a double-edged sword. But it was a movie, I mean, just a brilliant movie, I mean, wow, to say the least.
I mean, we got some insight into you this episode, but you escaping to watch Napoleon Dynamite because of the weight of what's going on around you, and then feeling bad because you got what you were looking for. I mean, relax a little bit, David. Jesus Christ.
It's not perfect. It's why I'm staring at the ceiling at, you know, at 2-3 a.m. every single day.
That's one of those movies. I'm sorry, you were going into a deeply personal place. Continue.
No, I'm not trying to give you sympathy or ask for sympathy. I'm just saying that, the witching hour is what I call it, when you just can't sleep and your eyes open and there's nothing you can do about it. And it happens to me every night, and I don't wish it on my worst enemy. And I don't wish sleeplessness on anybody, and there's nothing I can do about it. I've tried everything, the calm apps, I've tried medicine, you try everything. And and the guilt that I feel, you know, people have called it Jewish guilt, right? And I feel guilt about a lot of things in my life, and it's hard to deal with all of it. And when you escape and you think, my God, why am I so privileged that I get to escape? And it happens when you're watching Napoleon Dynamite and you're laughing at something that's so stupid and so funny. And you're thinking, wow, there's people around me who don't have this luxury that I have right now. It's not perfect, Mike, I'll tell you that.
Have you tried fight clubbing it? Going to support groups?
So, no. And here's why. I like one-on-one way better than groups, because my group therapy happens with you every Thursday.
All right. David Sampson, host of Nothing Personal. We appreciate your time. I really enjoyed this episode. This is one of the better episodes, and it's not carrying over a theme. We're going to bring back some of the themes. Maybe we'll even invite Ariel based on some of the conversation that we had in this episode in a future episode. I want to tackle Jack McKeon with you as we're getting back into normal. I don't know what this means for our themed episode, so I want to sneak in a Trader Jack episode before we may get a more regular David Sampson show going forward. Thank you so much, David, for being so honest and joining us. As always, check out Nothing Personal, his podcast. Follow him on Twitter. He's always putting out clips. He's good at this media thing. David Sampson, thank you for your time.